Hello and welcome to this Bytefix Pool of Experts podcast. My guest today is Steve Richardson, Sports Integrity and Investigations Consultant. Steve has substantial experience working in the Middle East and South Asia in particular. He's now back in the UK, and until recently, Steve was employed by the International Cricket Council, and before that he was the Senior Investigator for the England and Wales Cricket Board. Steve also brings considerable law enforcement experience, having worked his way up through the Metropolitan Police Service in London to the level of Detective Superintendent, dealing in particular with organised crime. Steve, very warm welcome from us to you, and thank you for accepting our invitation. If we can start by perhaps if you could give us an overview of where you think the world of sport is now in the fight against corruption.
Thanks, Andrew. And first of all, can I just say thank you to you and to Bytefix for the invitation to speak on the podcast. It all certainly helps with the fight against match fixing in sport. I think the answer to that is that the picture is mixed in terms of where sport is. There are a number of major sports who are in a reasonable place. They have good integrity units. They have expertise that enables them to prevent match fixing, but also deal with it when it arises. But there are many sports who don't have the resources, don't have the expertise. With the explosion that has taken place in online gambling, and it really has been exponential over the last 4 or 5 years, I can only see it going one way in terms of growing and becoming more of an issue. The pandemic has probably changed the landscape, and it certainly changed some of the methods that have been used by fixers to get hold of players, participants in sport, athletes. They are far more willing now, rather than trying to bump into them in a hotel or in a cafe somewhere, they will approach them online. They'll direct message them through Instagram, Facebook, other social media, and try and strike up a relationship in that way. It's very low risk for a corrupter to do that, and also very cheap and very easy. They can do it without even leaving their front room.
Is a lot of it to do with human resources as well, though, now, Steve, in terms of bodies, if you like, numbers of people available? Because, as you say, we do hear a lot about integrity officers coming into the sport, but very often it's perhaps just one person working across an entire global aspect of a sport. Do we have enough people in place as yet, do you think?
Some sports do. Look, I mean, integrity units will always say that they could do with more people to fight the battle against match fixing and corruption. But if you look at some of the sports integrity units, particularly in Australia, particularly well resourced, and actually that the funding for the resourcing in Australia comes from a levy that is placed on the betting companies. And that money can only be used, it's ring fenced for integrity work. That doesn't necessarily happen in Europe and other jurisdictions, so therefore the resourcing becomes more of an issue. If you look at some of the more, I'll call them minor sports, not in a demeaning way, but just in terms of that they are smaller than, say, football or cricket, tennis, for example, then sometimes they're operating on very limited resources just to govern the sport and just to do the administration that takes place. So to actually have a dedicated integrity unit can be very, very difficult for them to finance that. But my advice to them would be that they should very strongly consider putting resources into integrity. And I suppose you could view it in the same way as you would if you're running a company, running an organization, you protect your assets. You protect, for example, your building. You protect your people from outside risks and threats. You train them how to spot fraud, how to spot people who might bully, that sort of thing. But sports organizations, when it comes to they're athletes and match fixing. They don't always put the resources into it that maybe they should do in order to protect their athletes. What you're doing by doing that is you're protecting the value of your sport. You're protecting the integrity of the sport, which hopefully means that it becomes worth more to broadcasters, to the public, and you can grow your game, whatever sport that is.
I was reading in preparation for some things that you'd said previously around betting, and obviously there's a correlation, we have to assume a correlation between the rapid growth of online betting worldwide and the problems that we're seeing in terms of match fixing and corruption. But it was interesting, I think you were sort of saying that, well, don't necessarily see betting as a bad thing. There are things in place that can allow betting to sit alongside modern day sport and be a comfortable partner. So it's not necessarily the case that, get rid of betting and you get rid of match fixing.
No, well, look, that genie's already out of the bottle. You're never going to be able to get rid of betting. In many countries where it is legal, it's hugely popular. It generates revenue for governments and obviously for the betting industry. But it does carry risks, and leaving aside the risks of problem gambling, the risks of match manipulation, match fixing in sport is one of those risks. There are many jurisdictions where betting is illegal, but actually it still goes on. It just goes on underground and in the black market. And that becomes a problem for integrity units, sports integrity units, to actually identify what is happening in the betting markets. What I would say about the betting companies and the betting companies that are regulated is that they have an interest themselves in seeing sport being clean and seeing sport not being manipulated. The reason for that is they operate all their models on algorithms. What will take place within a match, a particular match, be it soccer, be it cricket, tennis, and the odds are generally set according to those algorithms. If something is fixed, be that a part of a match or the whole match, those algorithms don't work. So therefore, a betting company can lose a lot of money through match fixing because the algorithms won't do what they expect to happen during the match. They are very, very good at working with integrity units to actually pass information through to the integrity units on what is happening within the sport. These are referred to sometimes as betting alerts. And there are many sports who receive betting alerts from the betting industry, which gives them, an indication that something may have happened. That then needs to be investigated. And if you take tennis as an example, they get many betting alerts that they use in order to start their investigations, as well as the live information that they get. But it's always a good starter for them to see what is happening in the matches.
Now, before we move on to your area of specialisation, if you like, which has been cricket through your career, the other aspect, of course, has been your work with the police, the Metropolitan Police, in terms of trying to tackle organised crime and gangs. And another thing I found fascinating reading the kind of work that you've been involved with is just the level that we're now operating at in terms of the way these gangs work. And I know there was reference to things like burner phones, which fans of detective series across the world will be aware of, criminals using phones that just get thrown away and can't be traced. But that's the kind of level that we're now at, is it? That these gangs really are aware that they're being chased by authorities and by sports governing bodies and are really doing things at a very advanced level to avoid detection.
Yes, I don't think it's any secret that investigators in any line of work will consider mobile phones as a primary source of evidence and indeed intelligence. Certainly that's something that is used in major sports like cricket and tennis, And people are aware of that. In my experience, however, athletes don't necessarily know how to protect themselves because they're not career criminals. They're not like the people that I used to go after when I was in the police. And they don't, they make mistakes. They don't necessarily clean their phone as they would hope. And they don't take the sort of proactive measures that an organized criminal would take. Having said that, behind some of the match fixing does sit organized crime, and quite frequently disorganized crime, because it's not all about shadowy underworld figures sitting in smoke-filled rooms and plotting conspiracies to fix. I've seen match fixing be everything from a young person who has seen an opportunity by seeing a player in a hotel lobby. They have a gambling problem and they approach the player and speak to the player. It's a very low level, right the way through to sophisticated plots. Now, there are also some very, very rich people who are behind some of the match fixing plots, which makes you think they're not actually doing it for the money. Although a large amount of money can be made through match fixing, sometimes they do it for the thrill of the chase. And having power, being close to players. So there are many motivations as to why people are fixing matches.
And again, from your experience, Steve, we hear a lot these days about organized crime in terms of people trafficking, in terms of funding wars almost, and all sorts. You know, the areas are endless of involvement of criminal gangs. But can we expand a bit more, as you were doing there, on what kind of people are involving themselves in sport? Is it restricted to one area of organized crime, or are there literally, depending on what country, what continent it's from, all sorts of different motivations for people to get involved?
Yes, I think it does vary, as with any crime. You know, if you look at the Italian mafia in the United States being involved in match fixing as historically they have, then clearly they are highly sophisticated, highly organized crime groups, and very dangerous with that. Certainly some East European gangs who are into football in particular, and match fixing in football in Eastern Europe could also be placed into a category where they're very dangerous. However, certainly in my experience, there are probably more corruptors who are more akin to what I would say are fraudsters. And they're looking to try and get a relationship with a player and build a relationship with a player in order to hook them and get them involved in match fixing. And they'll keep that relationship running as long as they can, but and as long as it's useful. But they are not necessarily going to enter into threats with the player and threaten their families in order to get them to fix matches. It's more of a you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. But of course, what any athlete has to bear in mind, these people are not your friends. And you run the risk that one day, if the relationship turns sour, they will turn on you. And I don't mean necessarily in a physical, violent way, but they might send material to the authorities showing that you've been fixing matches. It might be voice notes, it might be photographs, screenshots. And that could finish your career.
We've talked before on this podcast with people about the fact that because it's sport, there's a tendency for people to think it's a victimless crime. It's only sport. A team only draws 2-2 when they could have won 3-2. A player gets knocked out in a quarterfinal when he probably wouldn't have got to the semis anyway. Is that a frustration for you? Do you feel that it isn't taken as seriously as perhaps other aspects of corruption across the world, be it in politics or whatever, are, that sport has this sort of base in it isn't really that serious?
So I think a lot of it is about a lack of understanding of what actually takes place, and the risks that it brings to the reputation of a sport. And if you look at what has taken place in amateur boxing with the Olympics over the last couple of years, you can see where there are integrity issues within the sport, that it can have a huge impact on the sport itself. It could jeopardize a sport's participation in the Olympics, for example. So there are large consequences, big consequences to sports lacking integrity. In terms of it being taken seriously, it was always very, very difficult to persuade law enforcement in a number of jurisdictions to get involved in match fixing cases. They do sometimes get involved, but you have to recognize the reality that most law enforcement entities globally have a number of priorities. Those priorities are to do with violent crime, acquisitive crime, bank robberies, drug dealings, gun running, people trafficking. And so when an investigation comes in that is maybe to do with somebody earning $20,000, $30,000 by fixing a match, and that is looked at by law enforcement, they can see the difficulties in investigating something like that, and it's not a priority. So what are the difficulties? Well, you might look at it and as a police officer, and your witness, the athlete who's been approached, might be in your country. That's great. But the person who approached might be in a third country somewhere else and never having set foot into your country. And if any betting is taking place, that could be taking place on the illegal markets. And it's potentially through a betting company that's registered in one of the offshore regulators. So the difficulties in actually investigating that and bringing it to a successful conclusion push it further down the list of priorities. So I do understand why law enforcement wouldn't have it as a high priority. But what that means is sports have to take it seriously because they might be the only people that are doing so.
And of course, that leads me on to one of the other things I was going to talk to you about was how sport deals with problems within sport. And one of the high profile things that I know you've been in involved with cricket was the case of the Australian ball tampering incident. Now, obviously, you might not, through contractual reasons or whatever, be able to talk about specifics. But again, where would you put that on your sort of scale of seriousness, Steve? Because I suppose some people would say it happens all the time in village cricket. Somebody's just trying to gain an advantage. Others would say that could fundamentally have affected the outcome of a match, which could fundamentally have affected the outcome of a test series, which could fundamentally have affected thousands of pounds of prize monies and things like that. I mean, where do you see incidents cross a line from being just a sporting issue to a major law enforcement issue?
Well, I think it's very important to be clear that ball tampering within cricket, within any sport, is not contrary to any anti-corruption code. It is contrary to the ethics of the sport. And I won't go into any details about the sandpaper incident for the reasons that you've said. But what I would say is look at the consequences of what took place at Newlands in South Africa on that day. Look at the impact it had on the individuals who were involved. Look at the impact it had back in Australia, in the country. Had huge impact. A number of very senior administrators left Cricket Australia within a relatively short period of time. So something that some might argue was something that takes place a lot on sports fields is people contravening that sort of rule can have big consequences. There's no doubt at all about that. So certainly in the case of corruption and match fixing, which once again that ball tampering was not, it's very, very important that sports have a framework in place before it happens so that it's contrary to the rules, so that athletes are educated and they're aware of what their responsibilities are, and so that the sp- sport knows what is going to take place as soon as an allegation is made. You don't want to leave it until the last, until it happens, so that you're in effect indulging in crisis management.
And let's move it along to the role of governing body, Steve, if we may, because as we mentioned, you've got good experience with both the England and Wales Cricket Board, with the ICC. As far as cricket goes, as you've mentioned, it's one of the leading sports. It's there with football and with tennis and other sports, perhaps worldwide, that are doing their bit in this fight against match fixing in particular and other forms of corruption. Is there more, though, that governing bodies can be doing still?
Well, there's always more, but that is quite often dictated by resources. I think at the end of the day, then it's incumbent on all sports and administrators to take it seriously. And as I said, make sure that they have a framework in place. Certainly the sports you've mentioned, cricket, football and tennis, have very experienced integrity units. They have policies, they have independent oversight, and they can deal with almost any risk or report that comes into the sport with regard to match fixing. The issue really lies in the areas of maybe the lower tiers, just below the absolute elite level. That's where the big risk is in match fixing. And quite often the governing bodies and the administrators who are dealing with sports in those smaller federations are struggling to do the work that they've got to do anyway without putting into effect a framework to protect the integrity of the sport from the threat of corruption. But of course, that's a big risk as well. That is a huge risk for them if they don't recognise it, don't put something in place, and don't protect their athletes is the bottom line. There are many resources out there that will help them. There's everything from the sort of things that the Bike Fix project is doing through to the UNODC. Interpol have a number of resources and are very good in the fight against match fixing. And there is plenty of help and guidance out there. And I know that the major sports such as football, tennis and cricket would be happy to give a smaller sport some guidance as to what they should be doing. That sort of cross-pollination, I suppose, between sports is something that needs to be encouraged, supporting each other to try and protect sport against the threat of fixing. The bottom line is quite a lot of the corruptors will cross over sports. They'll move between sports if the opportunity arises. And certainly we've seen fixers in cricket who have also operated within tennis.
Yeah. We'll come back to that in a moment, Steve. But is there more that can be done to protect athletes? We've mentioned athletes two or three times, and it strikes me that with some of the organisations in terms of Association of Tennis Professionals, in terms of FIFPro and all the different organisations that look after athletes, unions, if you like, trade unions for athletes, is there more that they can be doing? Because our very first podcast in this series with Moses Swebu, footballer in the National League in the UK, and it still resonates with me how he was just approached on a Thursday night training and he mentioned how some of these fixers are actually getting into clubs. They're actually buying up lower level clubs as apparently legitimate companies. And then it only becomes clear further down the line that actually it could be a match fixing operation. Is there more that can be done in terms of education?
Well, I think the education of the athletes is certainly key to protecting the athletes from match fixing. They need to be constantly reminded of what the threat is, what the risk is, and what their responsibilities are. But actually, professional athletes also don't want to be sitting in a room for an hour and talked at about the risk of match fixing, because everybody would sit in that room and think, well, that's not going to happen to me, so I don't really to worry about it. So really, I suppose the key is distilling down the key messages that you as a sports governing body would want to give to your athletes, and delivering those regularly. So it's not a question of delivering at once and then moving away. I think the important thing is that they're constantly delivered at least once a year. If you consider that, I think it's up to about 25% turnover in a professional team from one year to the next. So you need to constantly refresh the athlete education. You need to constantly reinforce the messages on what they need to do. Everybody knows they shouldn't match fix. Everybody knows that. Betting is a slightly different and slightly more nuanced issue for them, because quite a lot of the athletes will think, well, what's wrong with betting on my sport? You know, I can't see any problem with that. But there is a problem with it. It's been well articulated, and obviously it brings about risks if people start betting on their own sport. So, for example, in cricket, a professional cricketer, a contracted cricketer, cannot bet on cricket anywhere in the world. It is not just their own team, not just their own competitions are in, anywhere in the world. So it's very clear what they can't do. Inside information is always a very nuanced and difficult point to get across to players, that information from within a dressing room is actually valuable to gamblers, and that information should stay in the dressing room. And in actual fact, it's not just because of the anti-corruption codes that it should stay in the dressing room. You know, your coach and your fellow professionals are not going to be too happy about you leaking information that is going to be useful to the opposition. So everybody knows they shouldn't be doing that. What it boils down to, what do they do if they're actually approached? That's where the problem comes. Some, quite often, they don't know what they should be doing. So the messages on how they report are very, very important. And you can bet your bottom dollar that as soon as an athlete leaves that room, they're probably going to forget that this is how they report. So it's worth reinforcing the messages with, for example, posters in the dressing rooms, posters around where the players' dining rooms are to advertise whistleblowing lines, how they can report, that sort of thing, confidential hotlines. So it's a constant message that needs to be given to players. The single most effective thing that you can do with players to protect them is build a relationship with them. As an anti-corruption body, as an integrity body, build a relationship with the players, win their hearts and minds, win their trust, so that when something happens to them, like a corrupt approach, they'll pick up the phone and talk to you. That's ultimately what you want. And you want to reassure the players that if this happens to them, that you will take the problem off their hands and you will deal with it confidentially and professionally and take it forward to protect the sport. That's what administrators and governing bodies want as well, but they have to put the systems in place to affect that.
Because, as you say, dressing rooms are very much very close-knit affairs, aren't they? They might not want to go to the manager of the team, the coach that they've been working with for many years. As you say, it needs a route out, and that would be a very interesting way to see how that develops. And another thing, Steve, that's really sort of fascinated me over the period of doing these podcasts is just been the revelations. I mean, I've been around sports reporting for over 40 years, but the revelations that, you know, tournaments are now sort of happening that aren't actually happening. You know, we're getting reports from around the world of tennis events, perhaps, that are being billed as something online, but are probably just happening in somebody's backyard, if they're happening at all. Has that caught you going back? I don't want to overplay it, but going back to dealing with murderers and thugs in terms of your work with the Metropolitan Police in terms of catching criminals. Has it surprised you the lengths that people will go to, that I think a lot of the public and a lot of perhaps the media like me would still say, I just never understood, never believed that that kind of thing was happening?
Yeah, ghost matches where the don't actually take place, but you may have something up online showing that a match is underway. You may have commentary taking place. You may have the sound of a match in the background, but actually nothing is taking place. And it is purely and simply to entice people into betting. And of course, once you entice people into betting, you create liquidity in a market, and you then can expose that liquidity and take the money out of the market because you know what's going to happen because the match taking place. I mean, it's no secret, and it can be Googled, that in cricket there have been leagues put on and taken place. For example, one that I recall purported to be taking place in Sri Lanka, but actually took place in the north of India. Yeah. And people were wearing the uniforms, there were flags up that indicated it was Sri Lanka, but it wasn't. And yeah, these things are streamed. They're sometimes televised on local channels, and it's all to facilitate and enable the betting so that the liquidity can be exploited by the people who are behind the corrupt league. So yes, it does take place. It doesn't happen that often, but we do see it in sports integrity, certainly.
In the few minutes or so we have remaining, Steve, looking back over your career, you know, your last 10, 15 years in particular, working around cricket and working in different parts of the world, is it a problem that's worse in some parts of the world than others, or is that a complacent westernized view, perhaps, to think that that's the case? I'm thinking, you know, obviously you just mentioned about that cricket tournament there in India, but we've had problems with snooker in China, for example, and things like that, haven't we? I mean, is it that some areas of the world are more prone to this, or can it happen just down the road wherever you live, in America or in Europe or wherever else it may be?
Well, the bottom line is it certainly can happen anywhere. And if you take the UK as an example, There have been match fixing incidents going back to, people may remember the investigation into the Pakistani cricketers at Lords was actually a newspaper sting, but Sussex County Cricket Club had a problem in 2011. So complacency can be an issue. However, if you look at South Asia, As an example, there are countries in South Asia where their participants, their players, are what we would call more vulnerable. And they're vulnerable in part because people will try and target them, corruptors will try and target them, because they think they are an easy target. So what certainly from a cricket perspective, what that meant was we put a lot of work into trying to protect vulnerable cricketers, vulnerable participants, and making sure that they knew of the risks and that they could protect themselves and protect their teammates. So are different parts of the world more vulnerable? Possibly, but you can't be complacent no matter where you are, because cricket, for example, is a global game. Football is a global game. Tennis is a global game. So actually, it could happen anywhere. You can't necessarily say that it's all down to a particular area or a particular country. Nobody is safe from the threat of match fixing.
And just finally then, looking ahead, Steve, you're operating as a consultant. Your advice, I guess, is going to be valuable to lots of people. But looking over the next 5 years or so, as they always used to say in job interviews, where do you see yourself being in 5 years' time? But for you and this particular fight against match fixing, how do you think it's going to go over the next 5 years? We seem to be making progress. There seems to be more awareness, but it also seems that it's perhaps more of a widespread problem than perhaps anybody first thought.
Well it is a widespread problem, and people are starting to become aware of the risks, but it's still getting over that threshold of people investing in protecting their sport. So for sports integrity units that are linked to sports governing bodies, be it international or national, I think they will probably get busier. and the landscape of sport is changing. You look at, for example, golf with LIV and the money that's come in with LIV. The landscape of golf has completely changed. You look at the landscape of cricket with franchise cricket, that is changing. Saudis have just got into football and a lot of money is going that way. So the landscape of sport is going to change a lot over the next 5 years. So I think there will be a lot of opportunities within the sports integrity world. It's good that there are independent experts who are able to give advice to sport, because one of the important things I think for sports integrity is that there is an element of operational independence. If you don't have operational independence from the sport, then you run the risk of you run to that sport's agenda when it comes to integrity. So what an independent sports integrity unit or independent consultant can give you is it gives you that operational independence. And I know my former colleagues in the ICC value that operational independence very highly, because that's something that makes them very effective. They will act without fear or favour, and they will go where the evidence takes them, and nobody is going to say don't investigate that because it would be too embarrassing. That's not something that they would tolerate or any sports integrity professional should tolerate.
Well, Steve, the clock has beaten us. Our final whistle has gone. But Steve Richardson, thank you very much indeed for joining our Pool of Experts podcast. It's been fascinating to hear your story and to hear your thoughts. And once again, we're very grateful to you for joining us.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, and good luck with your work going forward.